So the civil war between the tribes of Benjamin and all the other tribes of Israel is over. Israel has won. Benjamin has been reduced to a mere 600 surviving men. What happens next? Well, here's one way of viewing what happens next. The Israelites are overcome with compassion for the Benjaminite survivors and have a deep desire for the 600 men to marry and have children and repopulate the stricken tribe. However, the Israelites are also righteous folk who can't break this vow they have made, preventing their daughters from marrying the Benjaminites. So they're at an impasse. Either they keep the vow and suppress their compassion, or they provide wives for the Benjaminites and sacrifice their righteousness. But then the impasse is broken by two strokes of genius on Israel's part. The first stroke of genius yields 400 brides for the Benjaminites, and the second stroke of genius yields a further 200 brides for the remaining Benjaminite survivors. And so things work out perfectly. No Benjaminite survivor lacks a wife, and no Israelite father has broken his vow. Compassion wins the day, but righteousness is also maintained. It's almost an Old Testament type of the gospel, is it not? A preview of the cross, where a similar impasse in the character of God will be broken. And divine compassion will win the day as he provides forgiveness and salvation for sinners, but divine righteousness will also be maintained as he punishes their sins by means of a substitutionary sacrifice. And so after all the darkness and the ugliness of this book, and particularly the last few chapters, Judges comes to an end on a fantastic note. Like all good books, it has a happy ending. That's one way of construing Judges chapter 21. And it's a very attractive way of construing Judges chapter 21. I'd love to preach the chapter along those lines this evening. The problem is, I don't think it's the correct way of construing Judges 21. I think it distorts and mishandles the text. And that being so, I invite you this evening to consider with me two main headings. And first of all, a sadder conclusion. A sadder conclusion. Because it seems to me that instead of the happy ending to Judges that I've just presented to you there, what we actually have here is a far sadder conclusion. And that becomes evident when we take note of several things. First of all, a switch. A switch. Think of those runners today competing in the Great North Run. And for an hour or so before the race, those athletes will have been warming up for it. I'm not talking about those who kind of go dressed as a chicken or something. I'm talking about the proper athletes who compete. And if you then had watched one of those athletes during the warm-up and then watched that athlete during the race, you would have noticed, of course, that the two activities are quite different, the warm-up and the race itself. During the race, of course, the athlete is running, powering along as fast as he or she can. During the warm-up, on the other hand, the athlete is sometimes lying down on the ground. Or bent double, perhaps, stretching various muscles. At other times, just standing, staring into the distance, preparing him or herself mentally for the event. And so these are quite different activities, the warm-up and the running of the race itself. And yet, of course, there's a consistency between them. You don't think, well, that's a bit odd. Why is that person bent double or lying on the ground 1 minute and then running like billy-o the next? No, it makes sense. These are two natural phases of what is really a single endeavour, competing in the Great North Run. Now, in Judges 20 and 21, we have Israel engaged in two quite different activities. But there isn't here that consistency between them. In chapter 20, Israel is bent on liquidating the tribe of Benjamin. The Benjaminites have acted like Canaanites, and so Israel treats them as Canaanites, entering into holy war against them, putting them to the sword, torching their towns and cities, and we discover now, vowing that their daughters will not marry any Benjaminite grooms. That's what we have in chapter 20. In chapter 21, on the other hand, Israel is all conciliatory and concerned for Benjamin's survival as a tribe. Now, if it were a case of the Israelites in chapter 21 deciding that the elimination of those last 600 Benjaminites just isn't feasible, you know, they're out there in the wilderness, they're at the rock of Rimmon, it's an inaccessible location, there's no way they can ever re-establish themselves as a tribe now anyway, that there's so few of them. So basically we've done what we've set out to do, we'll just leave them there and we'll get on with our lives as the 11 tribes rather than the 12 tribes of Israel. If that was how they were thinking, then that would be understandable. But proclaiming peace to the Benjaminites, which is what they do in verse 13, providing wives for the Benjaminites, which of course is what they're doing throughout this chapter, allowing the rebuilding of Benjamin's torched towns, which is what they do in verse 23, that's a different thing altogether, isn't it? I mean, imagine if the Israelites had done that with Jericho. The walls had supernaturally collapsed. The Israelites had charged in and destroyed the place. But then they'd left a few survivors, and they proclaimed peace to those survivors, and they provided wives for those survivors, and they'd allowed those survivors to rebuild the city of Jericho. I mean, it's unthinkable, isn't it? In Jericho, of course, the whole notion of the city being rebuilt, it was placed under a solemn curse. And Israel got into serious trouble with Yahweh because one Israelite man kept back a few possessions from the city and didn't destroy them. So I'm saying then that in Judges chapter 20, Israel treats Benjamin as Canaanite people, devoting them to complete destruction. But then in chapter 21, Israel treats Benjamin as no Canaanite people was ever treated by the Israelites, or was ever to be treated by the Israelites. And so there's this inconsistency, there's a switch. There's an enormous switch of policy from chapter 20 to chapter 21, a strange, unprecedented switch of policy that at the very least should make us as readers feel decidedly uneasy. So that's the first thing, a switch. Secondly, a silence. A silence. Of course, there is one circumstance in which such a switch would be justified. If Yahweh himself were to intervene here and were to command it. You know, if he were to suddenly say to the Israelites, look, just don't destroy those last 600. And in fact, provide wives for them and allow them to get going again as a tribe. If Yahweh intervened in that way, then of course this switch of policy would be justified. But he doesn't, does he? Now, it's important to remember at this point that the holy war, and we talked about this last week, the holy war against Benjamin in chapter 20, it has Yahweh's approval. Remember, we saw that. In verse 18, Yahweh gets involved and tells the Israelites which tribe should go up first against Benjamin. In verse 23, he gets involved again and the Israelites have become discouraged, but he tells them, go up against Benjamin. In verse 28, he gets involved again and he promises, tomorrow I will give Benjamin into your hand. In verse 35, the narrator tells us explicitly that the Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel. So the holy war against Benjamin in chapter 20, it wasn't Israel's idea. Yahweh was behind this. Yahweh was directing this. It had Yahweh's approval. And it's interesting that now, when we come to chapter 21, there's a real similarity between chapter 20, verses 24 to 28, and chapter 21, verses 2 to 4. So in both those paragraphs, Israel assembles at Bethel. In both those paragraphs, Israel weeps. In both those paragraphs, Israel sits there at Bethel weeping until evening. In both those paragraphs, Israel offers burnt offerings and peace offerings to Yahweh. In both those paragraphs, Israel addresses a question to Yahweh. Both those paragraphs are followed by Israel doing some careful strategizing. In the first case, in order to defeat Benjamin. In the second case, in order to obtain wives for Benjamin. So there are all these similarities. Yet there's one massive difference. There in chapter 20, verses 24 to 28, Yahweh speaks. And he tells them to go up, for tomorrow I will give them into your hand. Here in chapter 21, verses 2 to 4, Yahweh is completely silent. It's a glaring omission, a glaring silence, because of the comparison with chapter 20. In other words, in chapter 20, Israel has divine authorization to do what they then do and destroy the Benjaminites. Here in chapter 21, they have no divine authorization to do what they then go on to do and provide wives for the Benjaminites. So this switch of policy from destroying to being all conciliatory, it's from them, it's not from God. So a switch, a silence. Thirdly, a sarcasm. A sarcasm. It's interesting that the Israelites then, perhaps very aware of this divine silence I've just talked about, as they pursue this new policy now, and as they try to provide wives for the Benjaminites, they seem to try desperately hard to kind of clothe their actions with religious respectability. How do they do that? Well, by centering everything around Shiloh, around that venue, that location, Shiloh. So notice that the first batch of wives, the 400 wives, they are taken, verse 12, to Shiloh. That's where the Benjaminites will receive them. And then, of course, the second batch, the 200, they're actually obtained at Shiloh itself, in the vineyards around Shiloh. Now, what's the significance of Shiloh? Well, Shiloh was where the Ark of the Covenant was residing at this time. We saw last week that the Ark was temporarily brought to Bethel during the period of the actual battle between Israel and Benjamin. But basically, during these days, the ark resided in Shiloh. You read at the end of chapter 18, verse 31, that Micah's carved image was there as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. So the house of God, the tabernacle presumably, and the ark was there at Shiloh. And so Shiloh was the geographical focal point, if you like, of Israel's relationship with Yahweh. And it seems then that as long as this wife-acquiring project revolved around Shiloh, the Israelites could kind of convince themselves that it was a pious business. It was a pious project that they were involved in because it was revolving around Shiloh, the holy location. Which may explain two very odd little touches in our narrative. First, the description of Shiloh in verse 12. You notice the description of Shiloh in verse 12. They brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. The land of Canaan. And you think, hang on a minute, shouldn't that be the land of Israel? After all, the occupation of the promised land is well advanced by now. Okay, that we know there are still pockets of Canaanites around, but if anywhere is fully Israelite now, surely it's Shiloh. The Ark of the Covenant resides there. Yahweh His presence is there. Levitical worship occurs there. You can't get more Israelite than that. But I think the narrator has been sarcastic here. He's saying, when you use Shiloh merely to clothe your own unauthorized strategies with a bit of piety, you're as superstitious and as man-centered and as religiously bankrupt as the Canaanites who were there before you were. The place hasn't really changed. It's Shiloh in the land of Canaan, not the land of Israel. And then also you have that reference to Shiloh in verse 19. And so here we have the elders of the congregation talking. We know that from verse 16. And given then that Shiloh is this focal point where the house of God is, the tabernacle, the Ark of the Covenant, you'd think everyone would know where it was. Yet, do you notice all the geographical detail in verse 19? They said, behold, there's the yearly feast of the Lord at Shiloh, which is north of Bethel on the east of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Lebona. All these geographical details. And I think probably, again, the narrator is being sarcastic. You know how you're at university and it's final exams coming up at the end of 3 years and you have a friend on your course and he's not known for being a particularly diligent student. And so you kind of say to him one day, don't you think you ought to be going to the library a bit? You know the library, it's that big building at the back of the campus, you know, next door to the canteen. And, you know, you're being sarcastic. He knows where the library is, but you're making the point he doesn't go there very often. I think that's probably what we have here. And the narrator is saying rather sarcastically that these Israelites, they only go to Shiloh when they have a scheme that they want to clothe with a veneer of piety. They don't go there to worship Yahweh normally. And so we have a switch, a silence, a sarcasm. Fourthly, a statement. Because in verse 15, we have a pretty explicit statement, don't we? The second half of the verse, the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. And the narrator doesn't mean that, I think, in some very indirect sense. You know, the Lord is sovereign behind everything, and so there's a sense in which everything that ever happens can be attributed to the Lord. He doesn't mean that. He means in a very direct sense, what has happened to Benjamin, the destruction of Benjamin, the removal of Benjamin, the cutting off of Benjamin from Israel, the creating of this breach or this gap in the tribes, it's his doing. It's from him. We've said that already tonight. He was directing the military operation to destroy Benjamin in chapter 20. And verse 15 is just putting that very explicitly. Yahweh had done this. He'd made the gap. And so the Israelites, in now trying to provide wives and in trying to reestablish the tribe of Benjamin, they're counteracting God's action. He's reduced the 12 tribes to 11 tribes here. In the same way that later, of course, at the time of the Assyrian conquest, he will reduce Israel much, much, much more drastically. In the same way that in the New Testament, we have a reference to the Lord Jesus removing a lampstand, removing a church, removing a part of his people. That's what Yahweh has done that here. And the Israelites are kind of going against that then by seeking to reestablish the tribe of Benjamin. So a switch, a silence, a sarcasm, a statement, and then a fifth thing, a scandal. A scandal. I'm referring then to the way that Israel goes about providing these wives. These two actions, which together amass the 600 girls that are needed. And in assessing these two actions, we shouldn't use adjectives like clever and brilliant and resourceful, but adjectives like horrific, appalling, abominable. The first action is the destruction of Jabesh-Gilead. So the point about Jabesh-Gilead is that its people hadn't shown up when all the Israelites came together as one man to attack the Benjaminites. Jabesh-Gilead hadn't shown up. And that meant then that, number one, the Israelites now felt they had a pretext for destroying Jabesh-Gilead as a punishment for not showing up. And number two, they hadn't been there to make the vow, we won't give our daughters as wives to the Benjaminites. So they won't now be breaking the vow. Now, doubtless, the people of Jabesh-Gilead should have turned up with everyone else at that assembly at Mizpah. But their failing to do so is hardly a crime which merits them being wiped off the face of the planet. I mean, Israel is putting their crime here in the same category as Benjamin's crime. They're liquidating Jabesh-Gilead the same way that they went about liquidating Benjamin in chapter 20. So, failing to turn up at the assembly at Mizpah is now being equated with sexually abusing that concubine throughout the night in Gibeah. It's ridiculous. And of course, we have other no-shows, don't we, in Judges. Occasions when tribes or cities, areas don't turn up to fight against the enemy. And they're criticized for doing that, but they're not liquidated for doing that. Deborah, in her song in chapter 5, she criticizes those who didn't come and help in the battle, but she doesn't send 12,000 soldiers to wipe those places out. This is horrendous. This is brutality of the worst kind. And then the second action, of course, is kidnapping those daughters of Shiloh. And the point here, from Israel's perspective, is that because these girls are kidnapped, no one has actually broken the vow and given their daughter to a Benjaminite. But again, it's disgraceful behavior, isn't it? And we haven't got time to go into it, but the verbs that the narrator uses, they're verbs which we find in other Old Testament contexts, used of wicked men kind of seizing and plundering the innocent. And that's what's happening here. These daughters of Shiloh are innocent girls who are taking part in this festival, and they're being ambushed and kidnapped and seized. I mean, is what the Israelites do to these daughters of Shiloh all that much better than what the men of Gibeah did to that concubine in the first place that started all this? And so I'm saying this provision of wives, it's an absolute moral scandal. So instead of a happy ending, we have a far sadder conclusion. And there are these five reasons then why I say that: a switch, a silence, a sarcasm, a statement, a scandal. And in terms of application then at this point, let me just linger one moment on that last feature of the narrative I mentioned then, that the scandal, the scandalous way in which Israel provides wives for Benjamin. Because I think that highlights a couple of trends that are relevant for us today. For one thing, we have here cruelty being practiced in the name of compassion, don't we? Notice that. Cruelty being practiced in the name of compassion. In verse 6 and in verse 15, the Israelites talk about their compassion. So verse 6, it's the narrator saying, the people of Israel had compassion for Benjamin, their brother. And then again, verse 15, the people had compassion on Benjamin. So there's all this compassion that the Israelites have for Benjamin. And that seems so lovely, doesn't it? That they're feeling all compassionate for the surviving Benjaminites. Yes, but what about the citizens of Jabesh-Gilead, who are wiped off the face of the planet? What about the daughters of Shiloh, who are kidnapped? There's not much compassion showed to them. Rather, utter brutality and cruelty, as we've said. Their comfort, their safety, even their existence in the case of Jabesh-Gilead, is sacrificed in order that compassion can be shown to the Benjaminites. It happens today, doesn't it? You think of two men in a homosexual relationship, or two women in a homosexual relationship. And they want to be parents, just like heterosexual couples are. And so it's encouraged in our society that they be parents. It's compassionate. Compassionate fulfilling of their parental instincts. No one asks about the children, whether it's in their best interests to grow up with two daddies, two mums. Or a man who has decided that he's now going to live as a woman. And he's allowed to use female toilets, female changing facilities. Again, encouraged in our society. It's compassionate to to these folk who want to go through this? Again, no one asks, or many people don't ask, what about the women, the girls, for whom that is at best uncomfortable, at worst unsafe? And we need to recognize this then for what it is. Cruelty in the name of compassion. And I'm saying Judges chapter 21 perhaps helps us to recognize it, because that's exactly what we see going on here. And then another trend, which is closer to home, that what we have here also is a highly selective view of sin. A highly selective view of sin. Because it's not true to say, is it, that the Israelites here are utterly morally indifferent. No, there's one sin that means a great deal to the Israelites. One sin they'll do literally anything to avoid. What's that? Well, breaking the vow they've made. They've made this vow that they won't give their daughters in marriage. And, you know, they recognize it's in the law of Moses that if you've made a vow, you keep that vow and you take that vow seriously. And they're obsessed with that. Gross cruelty toward innocent victims, on the other hand, they have no qualms whatsoever with. Oh, they can wipe out Jabesh Gilead. They can ambush these 200 girls. That doesn't bother them. And it's something that we need to be wary of ourselves as Christians, isn't it? That sometimes we can be preoccupied, perhaps, with holiness in one area, while unholiness in another area doesn't bother us at all. We would never dream of a view in pornography. And yet, we would gossip about another person without even noticing we're doing it. We would never dream of using a swear word. And yet, we would fill our thoughts with covetousness, that thing we want. Never dream of getting drunk. And yet, we would have a lousy work ethic, Monday to Friday, in the office, in the factory, wherever we might be. You see what I'm saying? A selective view of sin. We must all be careful that we don't slip into that. So a sadder conclusion. And you're probably thinking, well, Dan, this is a very dreary end to the book of Judges, very dreary end to this series on Judges, which is why I just want to close then with our second heading, a subtler consolation. A subtler consolation. Because I think that there are brighter considerations that we may take away with us as we leave this chapter and this book. But they are not in your face. They are at a subtler level. And two then, in particular, as we close. First of all, let's just think for a moment about the tribe of Benjamin. Let's think about the tribe of Benjamin. And we've said then that Benjamin should have been wiped out. Israel's holy war in chapter 20 was a right holy war. Benjamin had become Canaanite and was to be treated as Canaanite. And Israel was right in chapter 20 in its attempted destruction job. Israel wasn't right in chapter 21 to then switch policy and try and ensure Benjamin's survival. And that being so, Benjamin surviving here in unsatisfactory circumstances, when Yahweh had actually wanted Israel to wipe Benjamin out, that being so, we would expect Benjamin's future to be utterly dismal. We would expect Benjamin to exist from now on utterly outside the sphere of God's blessing and God's favor. We wouldn't expect that ever again anything good would be associated with the tribe of Benjamin, because the tribe of Benjamin shouldn't exist anymore. And yet the Bible surprises us, doesn't it? And so centuries later, there's a time when Israel has many enemies. And the very existence of God's people is being threatened by these enemies. And God raises up a man. And that man is called Mordecai. And through Mordecai, and through Mordecai's careful raising of Esther, and the help and support and guidance and wisdom he gives to Esther, through all of that, God's people are rescued from seemingly inevitable destruction. The pipeline from which our Savior will one day come isn't severed as it looks like it's going to be severed by Haman. And we get the impression there are other Hamans at that time, others who hate the people of God. God's people are hanging on by a thread, but he raises up Mordecai. And through Mordecai, he not only saves his people, but he establishes them within that the world of that day. Who was Mordecai? Mordecai was a Benjaminite. His ancestors were the 600 survivors and the 600 women taken in such unsatisfactory circumstances. They were his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfathers and grandmothers. Or you go further still into the future. And God wants his people now to break out of its Jewish chrysalis, and he wants his people to become a multinational people. He wants the Gentiles to be incorporated. He wants the gospel to go to the ends of the earth. And he raises up one man in particular who will start that process and who will take the gospel across boundaries it's never crossed before and go to the Gentile world. A man called Saul. And who is Saul? A Benjaminite. He says, doesn't he, to the Philippians, he used to boast about being a Benjaminite. And it's so like God, this, isn't it? I mean, we have other examples of a similar principle. You think of David's marriage to Bathsheba. It shouldn't have been. Just as the tribe of Benjamin shouldn't have been any longer. David should never have been married to Bathsheba. She was another man's wife. And you think, well, that marriage is never going to have any significance in the purposes of God when it's such a bad idea in the first place. And yet, of course, it's from that marriage that Solomon comes. And the line of Messiah Jesus. We've mentioned Jericho tonight. You think of the city of Jericho. It was rebuilt. It shouldn't have been rebuilt. People paid a large price for it being rebuilt. It was rebuilt at the time of Ahab. Dark days. And again, you think, well, it's been rebuilt and it shouldn't have been rebuilt. God will never do anything good in Jericho. And what happens? God sends his son into the world. And he sends his son one day to the city of Jericho. And one of the most famous converts of the New Testament is a resident of Jericho, Zacchaeus, the tax collector. And again, God's doing this surprising thing. And it's wonderful, this, isn't it? I mean, we're all quite clear, aren't we, that bad things like Benjamin surviving here when it shouldn't survive, like David marrying Bathsheba, like Jericho being rebuilt. We're all aware that these bad things, they can't thwart God's plans and purposes. We all know that. But the Bible takes us further than that, doesn't it? And it says that not only do these things not thwart God, but actually in the end, they all conspire to bring about God's purposes and plans. God uses these things that should never have been. There is a great omega point of history, a great day to which everything is heading. The day when Christ will be unveiled and God will consummate all his promises and his kingdom will come and he will be all in all, as Paul puts it in 1 Corinthians 15. And in the building up to that day, God is using everything. Everything conspires to that. Everything is bent towards bringing about that day. Even the worst things, the things we think that can't possibly contribute to that day coming about. It will. It does. Because God uses everything in order to bring about his plans and purposes. This resourceful, amazing God, whose script no one else could ever have possibly written. So that's an encouraging consideration to take from tonight. That even the worst things in your life, the worst episodes of your past, the most shameful, dark periods, and you think, well, I'm glad I'm forgiven for those, but I know that nothing good can ever come of them. They're just black holes. They're just wasted periods of my life. No. God will use even those somehow to his glory and to the furtherance of his purposes. So there's a tribe of Benjamin. And then the other thing just to think about is the last sentence of the book of Judges. Or the last verse rather. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And remember, you may not remember, but I said a few weeks ago when we started this final block of five chapters, 17 to 21, throughout which we have this refrain, no king, no king, no king. I said that, Judges has been throughout a gospel book, a good news book. That's why it's called Judges, not Judgments. It's been a book about salvation, about God raising up deliverer after deliverer after deliverer. And all those deliverers, of course, are miniatures of the deliverer. They're all types. They're all little pointers to Jesus Christ. Samson is, Gideon is, Jephthah is, Othniel is, Ehud is. All these guys are. And it kind of seems then, on a superficial reading of Judges, that you have all these wonderful types of Christ, all this gospel, all this good news, until you come to the end of chapter 16, and then suddenly we have chapter 17 to 21, and it's all dire, and it's all abject, and it's all about sin. It's just an exposure of depravity, and it's a very strange and depressing way for this gospel book to end. But I said, no, the Messiah is there in these last five chapters as well. He's there, not in types this time. You won't find any types of Jesus in these chapters. Lots of anti-types, no types. He's there rather in this refrain. Because this refrain, in those days Israel had no king, it's not written, I said, by some naive guy who didn't realize that actually soon Israel would have a whole load of kings and they'd be just as bad as everyone who had gone before. And they would actually share in the moral depravity of God's people. They wouldn't raise Israel's morals one little bit. No, this refrain isn't looking ahead to that series of kings that you read about in the books of Kings and Chronicles. It's looking ahead to one king. To the king. To a king who would emerge one day who can actually transform the human heart. Who doesn't just rule wisely and justly in all sorts of external ways, but who can actually reach into the human heart and change it. And this refrain is saying Israel didn't yet have that king. And implied is that in that is the thought one day Israel would, one day God's people would have that king. Do you know that king? King Jesus. The king previewed so wonderfully in all kinds of figures throughout this book. And the king screamed out for in these last five chapters of the book, where everything is messy, everything is ugly, everything is depraved. Do you know this heart-transforming King Jesus? King Jesus' rule is extensive. Jesus shall reign where'er the sun doth his successive journeys run. And it's a growing kingdom, and it's extending to more and more places and parts of this world. King Jesus' rule is extensive, but it's also intensive, the Bible teaches. It goes in to a man or woman's life and heart and changes their whole outlook, all their motives, their deepest aspirations. If that isn't true of you, you might say you're a Christian, but you're not a Christian. If it's just about external things like coming here on a Sunday. No, a Christian is someone who is a subject of this king who reaches into his subjects' hearts and changes them. Have you been changed deep within? Otherwise, there'll be an external religion, but you won't really be in any different place from the Levite we've looked at, or from the Benjaminites or the Israelites that we've looked at over these chapters. Do you know this heart-transforming King? And if not, come to him tonight and say, Jesus, King of my life, I crown thee now. Be my King. Change me. Change me in the depth of my being. Make me yours. May it be so. Amen.